So today I am with Professor Hayley Fowler, who is Professor of Climate Change Impacts and the Royal Society Wolfson Research Fellow at Newcastle University. Hello, Hayley.
Hi.
Could you introduce yourself, what you do, and what your sort of specialisms are?
So, I mean, as you've said, I'm a professor at Newcastle University. I specialise in looking at climate change impacts, particularly on extreme events, floods and droughts, and extreme rainfall as well. Over the last decade, I suppose, we've been developing a whole new set of climate change models with the Met Office, which we've based on their weather forecast model. And these are really cool models, actually. So because they're weather forecast models, we can simulate really detailed information about potential changes to future climate. We can simulate things like thunderstorm events and things like that. And so if you're doing a whole load of work really thinking about how extreme events will change, and in particular, summer rainfall extremes and flash floods that affect our cities. We've been doing a whole load of other work as well, based on trying to collect together a new set of observations of rainfall from around the world. And that's been quite challenging, but very interesting. And we've managed to collect together a data set now for over 25,000 rainfall gauges around the world that collect information at sub-hourly scales, and that's really been able to show us what's happening to these rainfall intensities around the world, and which is really important, I think, for planning as well, in terms of understanding what's likely to happen to these very intense rainstorms in the future, and I suppose what we're seeing now.
So what could you sort of sum up any kind of general findings in terms of the rainfall, for example?
So as the world warms and as temperatures rise, and we've obviously seen a warming of about a degree or just over a degree now since pre-industrial times, as the atmosphere gets warmer, it can actually hold more moisture, and not only that, but the ocean becomes warmer as well, and that can basically evaporate more moisture into the atmosphere. So you've got more moisture being evaporated into the atmosphere and more moisture being able to be held within the atmosphere as well until it saturates, because a warmer atmosphere can hold more moisture. And so what we would expect with warming is that we would get an increase in rainfall intensities. It's about a rate of something like 6% per degree warming we see, and that's what we're seeing. But what we're finding as well is you get all of these interesting feedback effects in clouds as well, and that actually means that at shorter durations we get higher increases than what we would expect from this increase in atmospheric moisture in the atmosphere. And so what happens is, if you can imagine a storm, the actual really intense bit in the centre of the storm may become even more intense, and these short bursts of rainfall become more intense, whereas the actual storm itself may not actually become bigger, but parts of it, you know, it becomes more intense in its centre but perhaps smaller, or it becomes more intense and it can become bigger as well in some regions where you don't have a limitation in moisture. So I mean, in general, we're going to see an increase in rainfall intensities, and we have seen that in observations.
Yes, well, we've all seen it in our lives, haven't we? Recently, it's been very rainy.
It certainly has this year, yeah.
It's so how could you compare this year to previous years? Is it sort of ridiculously off the scale? Because I mean, it feels very different.
Yeah, I mean, it's been the wettest February on record, the Met Office reported, and they actually had to set a new scale for their figures that they produced, the map that they produced showing the percentage anomaly above average, because the whole of the UK was the same colour, because everything was above, or most of, a lot of the UK was above 200% above average. So they had to then basically produce a new scale, and some places were more than 400, so they're four times more rainfall than you would expect in an average February. So wow. Yeah, I mean, huge. And everywhere had more than you would expect on average, and most places had double, at least double. So
double. So double doesn't sound like a 6% increase. That sounds more severe. So in the short term, is the sort of severity higher than you were perhaps expecting in terms of where we are in terms of temperature rise?
I mean, you can't really look at it on an event by event basis.
Right.
But I mean, yeah, so you just can't look at it on an event by event basis. It's kind of an average over a number of events. But yeah, I mean, that's something to think about as well, is that's just thinking about the temperature increase and what effect that will have on the storm. But of course, you've also got a lot of other effects going on from, for example, position of the jet stream, and that affects the storm track and where that happens across the UK. It's also whether storms will become slower or whether they will become more clustered in time. There seems to be some evidence to suggest that storms may become slower in the future. And of course, if they become slower, they can sort of linger for longer and have more rain over a particular catchment or a particular location. You know, if the storm track stays in one place, then you tend to get storms happening over the same part of the country again and again. And I mean, one thing that seems to be have happened this year is, you know, every weekend we've had a big storm, and then during the week it's been okay, and then we have floods at the weekend, and that seems to be that we're getting, you know, a big storm coming through every 7 to 8 days.
Yes.
And again, you know, is that clustering something to do with climate change? And it's not something we understand well enough yet, that clustering in time of storm systems. We need to understand more about why that happens, and whether it is something that's going to become more common in the future.
So I'm kind of interested to ask you two questions, and you can choose probably which one to answer first. One is how you got interested in rain, and well, how you ended up sort of studying this, what was the route, and I'll ask the other question in a minute once you've answered that, actually. So what led you to kind of be a specialist in this area?
That's quite, yeah. I mean, it's interesting, actually, because when I was at school, I really wanted to do history at GCSE. Hmm. And I was persuaded by one of my parents' friends, who was a doctor, actually, to do geography, because she thought it went better with... my favourite subject was maths at school, and sciences as well. And she was like, no, you want to take geography. And it was nice that she... I mean, I've always thought and gone back to that, really, in the sense that I ended up getting a bit sick of maths at A-level because I was doing too much of it, and it was a bit too abstract. Mm. I hadn't done the right A-levels to be a doctor or an engineer, because none of my family had ever been to university before, and I guess I hadn't really thought about it properly. And so I ended up going to Cambridge to do a geography degree. Mm. But I've always been really interested in how things work. Mm-hmm. And I think geography for me is all about... how learning how the natural world works and understanding processes. So it's made it a long convoluted response to this, but basically I've kind of then gone into engineering, which is where I work now, because I'm interested in not just understanding processes, but how we can, I suppose, use that understanding to benefit society. Mm-hmm. Through engineering as well. And rainfall, I've always been really interested, I suppose, in since I started my geography degree, in how water shapes the landscape. And I ended up doing a master's up at Newcastle in water resource systems engineering, And then being offered a PhD to look at drought, actually, and the response of the 2005-2006 drought, where Yorkshire ran out of water. Oh, sorry, 1995-96 drought. It's a long time ago now, where Yorkshire ran out of water, and really thinking about that and how climate change might make that worse in the future. So I've been looking at drought now and then floods, because that obviously became more prominent in the early 2000s. We started getting a lot of floods and everybody was very interested in rainfall. Mm-hmm. And I've kind of migrated across there.
With the sort of hat on of translating that for people like myself, you know, the layperson, what do you find at the moment with the climate crisis kind of coming up the news agenda? What are you noticing in terms of just communicating out to the broader public? Have you been asked to do more of that, or are you finding you enjoy that, or how is that, you know, when you're sort of used to being perhaps sort of super detailed and super technical in your work? Like, how does that sort of translation occur across to the sort of public?
Yeah, I mean, I get asked to give quite a few public talks and, you know, media type things as well. But and I've always been interested in that, and I think that engaging with the public is really important in the job we do as scientists as well, actually. Mm-hmm. In terms of how busy I've been recently, then very... I think that it's really great. I'm far too busy at the moment in terms of requests to talk to various people, to be involved in events like your own event, to be involved in things like we were supposed to have a Climate Action Week this week at the university.
Would you like to talk a bit about that? Because obviously you're based in Newcastle, and I would have been doing a gig at the Sage Gateshead with you coming on to do the post-show discussion with me, and the coronavirus has meant that we've all got to stay away from each other, basically. And so the people who are listening to this, a lot of them will be based in and around the area, so it'd be really interesting to hear a bit more about the local stuff that's going on.
Yeah, well, I mean, this week we were supposed to be having Zion Lights from Extinction Rebellion talking this evening at the university. That's been postponed. I mean, the events haven't been cancelled, I suppose. They've been postponed. We don't know when till yet, but later in the year. Tomorrow night we were supposed to be having a panel discussion about do we need the fossil fuel industry to help in the transition to net zero, which I think is a really interesting discussion to have as well. Yeah. And we had some really prominent climate scientists, members of the Committee on Climate Change, obviously oil industry representatives, and Leo Hickman from Carbon Brief coming up to chair it. But obviously that will be postponed till probably November or something like that now. And then Thursday, we were having prominent climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe visiting on her tour. But again, she had to go back to the States. It's a good job she did, though, because there's no flights anymore.
Yeah.
But yeah, that would have been awesome. It would have been awesome. But anyway.
So these are actually names that I think it's worth people really following up online. All of the people you've mentioned, I've learnt a lot from. So Leo Hickman is Carbon Brief. Catherine Hayhoe, H-A-Y-H-O-E. She's Catherine with a K, I think. You also mentioned the Committee on Climate Change. Was that going to be Chris Stark?
No, we had Julia Brown coming up, okay. Baroness Brown.
Oh, yeah. And you also mentioned some oil execs. That's brilliant that you were kind of bringing them into the conversation. Who were you getting in?
We had one of our alumni, Marcus Richards, coming up to talk to us as well. And we also had Professor Sonia Senevaratne from ETH Zurich, who was one of the lead authors of the 1.5 degree report coming over as well. But obviously she's not able to fly.
Yes. Is it something where people can actually sign up to a sort of departmental mailing list at all to find out more about this? Or
It's part of the Insights, Newcastle University Insights public lecture series.
Fantastic.
So, and yes, it was a sign-up event, but we were using our new 650-seater Frederick Douglass lecture theatre. Mm-hmm. So we were hoping it would be a very big event, and hopefully it still will be, but just later in the year.
Okay, so people can sign up for the Insights lecture series. I've been to one of those. And
not at the moment, but yes.
Not for the moment,
when,
yes.
When we restart again, yeah.
Postponed insights. Not too many insights just now. So I want to sort of jump, if I may, to ask you in a fairly straightforward way, what is your sense at the moment? I mean, right at this exact moment, obviously, with everything postponed, we're all pretty distracted by coronavirus. But it seems to me there is lots of interesting kind of parallels and, of course, differences between the two major global crises. But, you know, if it's possible for you to answer, what's your sort of sense at the moment on where we are with climate change and where we are with our kind of response to it? You know, you're professor of climate change impact, so you're obviously seeing what's happening. You know, what's your kind of feeling on it, you know, really?
I mean, I mean, my sense is that we're still not doing anywhere near enough as a country, as a international community, as a society. But we have started to see, I think, some level of change and some level of action being taken, and this push to national government to take more action as well, I think, over the last year. Mm-hmm. And I mean, particularly the sort of Greta Thunberg effect, really. Mm-hmm. You know, pushed by the school strikes, pushed by people like Extinction Rebellion, who've put these things much more prominently on the agenda. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're still well behind where we need to be in terms of what people, what the nations have pledged with Paris. Mm-hmm. The Paris pledges, if we manage to meet them, will only take us to 3.5 degrees of warming by the end of this century. So, you know, we're not going to
say that again. That's rather important. The Paris Agreement takes us to 3.5.
3.5 degrees by the
end
of the century.
I thought the Paris Agreement was kind of trying to keep us to 1.5.
Oh, it is, but the pledges that nations have made so far, if they stick to them, as I say, because they're non-binding, basically takes us to 3.5 degrees of warming. So you can see how far we are from pledges that nations have...
Could you describe to the listeners what 3.5 looks and feels like?
I mean, I can suggest some things, I suppose, from climate model results, obviously.
Yeah.
We're talking about the full extinction of coral reefs. I mean, that might even happen at 2 degrees warming. There's a whole load of tipping points that may be reached. I mean, this is the problem that we think as scientists, that there are some potentially dangerous tipping points that we might reach in the natural climate system after about 2 degrees of warming. Things like, for example, some accelerated melting of the Antarctic ice sheets and the Greenland ice sheets, and you can get quite potentially rapid sea level rise. You know, things like mega droughts happening. Extreme events increasing, which we're seeing already, but obviously with 3.5 degrees of warming, you would see quite different potential. I mean, you know, warming in certain areas, big warming in certain areas. 3.5 degrees is a global average, so you'd
right.
see much larger.
Even.
No, so you see much larger increases in temperature over land than the ocean, and you see much larger increases at the poles as well, or in the in the sort of high latitudes, particularly in the northern hemisphere. And so you'd see much bigger changes, say, in the UK or Europe or further north than you would in, say, the tropics. And extremes change more than the means as well. So if you're talking about extreme temperatures, they will change or increase more than the mean.
That's interesting.
So yeah, so if you can imagine all of those things, they're not good particularly. But yeah, so where we are now in terms of what we've pledged is not a good place. But I mean, in terms of hope, trying to finish on a hopeful note, I think that there's a whole load of grassroots type things going on now, certainly in the UK, in other countries as well, and particularly in the UK there's a whole load of city scale type activities going on, and I'm part of one of these at Newcastle, where we've recently formed a climate change convention, it's called, with the City Council, the two universities and the NHS Trust being the major emitters in the city of carbon dioxide. And also, I suppose, the major players in terms of trying to reduce the emissions. And we formed something called a Net Zero Task Force, which is basically trying to take Newcastle City as an entity to net zero by 2030 or 40. These things are pushing ahead, and you know, we've looked at the numbers and we've realised really how difficult it is going to be to get to net zero fast. And then all of the changes we need to make.
How can the people of Newcastle and Gateshead and the surrounding areas listening to this, if they want to sort of join in with such a thing or try to support it, is there anywhere that they can kind of sign up or read more about it? Or
Well, I mean, the North of Tyne Authority is going to be convening a citizens' assembly, a bit like the one that's happened at the national level.
Yeah.
So that's one way. I'm not sure exactly how they're going to be choosing people to be part of that, but certainly that will be happening at some point, and obviously will be delayed, I'm sure, because of the coronavirus. So maybe it'll happen later in the year. It was supposed to be established by the summer, but I think that probably won't. I don't know, but it probably won't happen now. I mean, other ways that people can get involved, I suppose, are through the sort of local action groups as well. A lot of these are based around transport, actually, but I mean, that's one of the big things that we really need to change. So about a third of our emissions come from transport in the UK.
Gosh.
Yeah, and about 55 or 60% of that comes from cars.
So,
really? Yeah, yeah.
Cars. So that's very different from the global numbers, isn't it? That's interesting.
I don't know, actually. I think it's, well, certainly in most Western countries it's quite high in terms of transport.
Right.
So
people thinking about wanting to do something, actually leaving your car at home every other drive.
Yeah,
would
absolutely.
Be a great start.
Yeah, and I mean, this is one of the things that coronavirus might be interesting for, actually, in terms of I mean, there's interesting data coming out from China and Italy so far in terms of the reduction in air pollution in both places because of the lack of cars mainly being used. And obviously, we will be using a lot less carbon because of this as well, which is a good thing. And particularly, you know, flights are all grounded at the moment and various other things. You know, I think one of the really nice things that might be a knock-on effect of this, since it is, you know, it is going to happen, is that we're all thinking much more carefully about travel, actually, and particularly about, not necessarily about our holidays, I suppose, because I think, you know, everybody needs a holiday every so often, but about more about business travel, and is there that real need to take a flight to go and have a meeting for a day, or is there a real need to travel to London? You know, there'll be a lot of advances made in the next few months in these remote conferencing facilities, in my opinion.
Yes.
Because it needs to happen, and quickly. And, you know, at the university today, we've just gone to remote teaching until October. We're now not allowed to face-to-face teach, so we've got to come up with really novel ways of online teaching, so that may become much better as well. So I think it's going to be really interesting. We might see a bit of a revolution in that kind of online stuff, which probably should have happened 5-10 years ago but didn't, but maybe this will force us to do something a bit
more. Which feels like a positive, doesn't it? At the same time, I unfortunately watched the Dirty Streaming doc on BBC Three the other day, which shows you data centres and how much energy they use and how awful they are. So there's a sort of, there's still a downside to the internet. It did make me think I should use video less, because apparently it's like 75% of sort of data usage is videos. But it's good to think about the positives, and it's definitely where I want to stay always in terms of just thinking about what we can do, and being, you know, practical about things as well, trying to be collaborative. I mean, a big thing seems to me in both Corona and in the climate crisis that actually they're massive problems that no single country can solve on its own, and therefore collaboration is required, and collaboration is relevant at all levels. You know, there's lots of voluntary groups already doing sort of COVID-19 responses, and looking after elderly neighbours and so on. So,
absolutely. I mean, there's some great stories coming out in terms of people helping each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the other thing is that, you know, in this sense, we're trusting experts, which is interesting because we don't, for some reason, with climate change.
Yes.
But I think the other thing it teaches us, and I think this is something that people don't think about enough, is the fact that we can always do something to reduce the future risk.
Yeah.
So at the moment, whether it's, you know, the government's change of heart yesterday, basically saying, okay, we should all socially distance ourselves mm-hmm. with coronavirus, or whether it's, we can all take individual actions or push businesses, pension funds, government to take more national or international actions to actually address the climate change problem. It's never too late to do something to reduce the future risk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever we do will improve our chances in the future. And I think that's the same for climate change as it is for coronavirus.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that we're all doomed and this is where we have to be. We can change the future.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good ending, isn't it?
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Thank you very much for chatting with me. We can change the future. Hayley said it here. You heard it here first. And we are thinking that later in the year, it might be that if people have questions, that we would like to try and answer those. So do feel free to get in touch with me if you would like to pose a question to Hayley. And meanwhile, it sounds like there's a few things going on in Newcastle, so do look those up. And thank you very much for listening, and thanks for talking to me, Hayley.
Great, no worries. Thank you very much. Okay.
I was speaking to Hayley Fowler by phone because we were unable to meet in person at the Sage Gateshead. We were going to have a post-show discussion after my gig of 12 years. When you hear this, you may be looking forward to the live stream, or you may have just listened to it. And Hayley and I really would love to hear what you make of the concert and any questions that you have. So please do get in touch via sarahnichols.com. You can also find me on Twitter, Sarah Piano, or Facebook, Sarah Nichols Pianist. And I really hope to hear from some of you, and no doubt Hayley would love to see some of you at the Climate Action events that happen in Newcastle. So do take care of yourselves, and thank you very, very much for listening. Goodbye.